All righty. We're in 1 Kings chapter 12. Didn't realize the college class would be here tonight, so our class is twice as large as normal. I don't have enough handouts for everyone, because normally y'all are in the back, but I do have a few. We're going to pick up in chapter 12, actually, of 1 Kings. I've just said that, but I do have, a couple of extra copies, if anyone needs any, starting with chapter 13. Anybody? Pass one over to Matt. I'm sure he'll have it. You have one, Matt? Okay. We do have that. Yeah. If you would. Ending of chapter 11 is where Solomon has passed and Rehoboam has taken over in chapter 12. And so far, the kingdom is still somewhat united. As we begin chapter 12, and as we begin the first few verses of chapter 12, we see that what's left of the United Kingdom has gathered together and come before Rehoboam and asking him a request, saying, "We know how Solomon was with the northern kingdom of Israel. Please lighten our burden. Lighten our taxation or yoke that Solomon had placed on us." And we're reminded of the 12 regions that Tom had mentioned before, that the northern provinces were taxed higher and seemed to have a higher burden. And so they're asking Rehoboam, reconsider what Solomon has set up, lighten it for us. He says, Rehoboam asked for 3 days to consider this, and we'll get back together and he'll give his answer. Then we go to verses 6 through 15. But in the meantime, Rehoboam calls on the elders or advisors that worked with Solomon, asks for their advice. And they say, "Well, you should grant the wish of these people. Speak kindly to them. Lighten the burden. And they'll be yours, or they'll follow you in your new reign as new king after Solomon." Then, verse 8, Rehoboam turns to the young men he grew up with. And of course, they say pretty much the opposite. They remind him of what Solomon had done to them, the burden he had put on them. And he said, they suggested, "Why don't you add to the yoke, add to the burden?" Solomon had disciplined with whips, but they said, "Why don't you discipline with scorpions?" Verse 12, the people returned to find out what his answer was from Rehoboam. He followed the advice of the younger men he grew up with, spoke harshly to the people, told them he was going to increase their burden, increase their yoke, was not going to listen to them, was not kind to them. But as it says in verse 15, this is part of God's plan because it's going to further push the northern kingdom away from Rehoboam and divide the kingdom. So we see God's wisdom in this, but it looks kind of harsh in what Rehoboam's doing to these people, not granting their wish. And it also teaches us a lesson that you careful who you seek your advice from. But again, we obviously see, again, it's part of God's plan. But yet he does follow the advice of the younger men as opposed to the wise older elders who had already served Solomon previously. So it's dividing the kingdom as we look at verses 16 through 24. The kingdom is further pushed apart. Israelites, verse 16, began to question why these things are taking place. Of course, we're looking back, we know, and we can see the verses that say this is part of God's plan. They couldn't see this necessarily as we can. So far in verse 17, Rehoboam has control over the southern portions, Judah, and so forth. So he sends Adoram, or Adoram, however you say it, Adoram, I guess. It doesn't necessarily say where he sends him or why. He sends him to kind of seem to take control of these Israelites or speak to them, rally them or whatever. Adoram's position was over the forced labor prior to this. And again, Rehoboam just sends them to try to take care of this, and they stone him to death. That was the Israelites' reply to Rehoboam sending this gentleman try to take care of this. Rehoboam immediately hightails it back to Jerusalem. Very scared. Doesn't want a part of this. In the meantime, verse 20, Israel, the northern tribes, Jeroboam has returned to them. So they say, well, let's make Jeroboam our king. So they counsel, get Jeroboam and make him king over the northern portion of Israel in the meantime. Verse 21, Rehoboam finds out. When he gets to Jerusalem, he finds out. He gathers some 180,000 warriors to send them up north to take care of this problem, to bring them back under control and say, what's going on here? To restore the kingdom back to himself, to Rehoboam. Verses 22 through 24. The word of God comes to Shimei, a prophet, tell him to go to Rehoboam and tell the people, they're not to go fight their brothers. They're not to go fight against the children of Israel. This is of God. This is God's plan, this division. Jeroboam is to be king and Rehoboam is to be king. Fortunately, they listen and heed to and don't go fight their brethren. So now we've got the divided kingdom. Northern kingdom of Israel, southern kingdom of Judah. And as you've noticed, the beautiful artwork on the board behind me, I've already had some comments from Devin that I should have had a cartographer to do this nice artwork. But nonetheless, this is a rendition, and yes, I could have shown a map up here, but I couldn't actually draw on it. But anyway, it's kind of a simulation of the Palestine or Promised Land, Canaan, however you like to refer to it. Mediterranean Sea, the Great Sea. We've got the Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee, Lake Hula. There's a couple places we're going to refer to. Of course, right off the Dead Sea, remember, is the city of Jerusalem. That's one of the key points. And just north of Jerusalem is the boundary off the Dead Sea, roughly. Of course, it's just guesswork on my part. I'm not a map person, a cartologist. But nonetheless, just off the Dead Sea, just north of Jerusalem, and somewhere like this is where the kingdoms are divided. We have our northern kingdom of Israel, southern kingdom of Judah. And the teacher that I've been for quite a while, I always look for acronyms. Just think of it, I over J, because I comes first in the alphabet, over J. So now you've got it in your mind, Israel's over Judah. Okay? So now you've got the two kingdoms separated already. So, it was united, now it's divided, but it's I over J alphabetically. Okay? And then the next step is that it was united under Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon's first son, or not first son, but the son that's taking over now is Rehoboam. Rehoboam takes over the southern. So that's where Rehoboam takes over. Because the J's don't go together. So therefore, it's Jeroboam to the north. And again, J comes before R in the alphabet. So there you have it again. I over J and J over R. A little bit of a, it's not necessarily an acronym, but yet it's a little bit a way to remember which one's which in the divided kingdom. Jeroboam to the north, Rehoboam to the south. And we're going to start with the northern kingdom. Well, we talk about both in 16 through 24, but it's going to refer to talking about Jeroboam's decision for the northern kingdom of Israel. Of course, we see what Rehoboam, it's kind of shaky start. He's back in Jerusalem. He left when they killed Adoram. So, we're going to talk about Jeroboam, verses 25 through 33. We pick up with Jeroboam. He goes and builds Shechem, and I should have put it on the map, but Shechem is to the north of Jerusalem, and it's even north of Bethel. I'll get to that when we get to the, actually it's now when we get to the putting of the two. So anyway, let's go to that. He builds Shechem. He lives there. He realizes the division is just north of Jerusalem for the northern kingdom. This is Jeroboam again to the north. How are these people going to go to Jerusalem for the feasts, for the sacrifices, to the temple? They're cut off from the temple. So very quickly, he immediately decides to build two idols, two golden calves, in two different locations and make it convenient for the people so they don't have to go to Jerusalem after all. So Jeroboam comes up with a plan to make these two idols. He puts one in Bethel and one in Dan. All right, let me go ahead and show you where those are, and then we'll look at another verse in relation to that. All right. Again, Jerusalem is just off the Dead Sea, just north of Jerusalem and a little bit to the east. North and east is Bethel. And then kind of straight north of Jerusalem is Shechem, the one that he had built earlier, Shechem. Now, Bethel is where they put one of the idols, just north of the border, just south is Jerusalem, put one of the calves. And then north of Lake Hula is Dan. And it's roughly, really on the map, twice as far as the Sea of Galilee is to Lake Hula, again, the same distance to Dan. So he puts an idol in Dan, way up to the north, and then one down here at Bethel, to make it even more convenient for the people. So they've got a northern idol and a southern idol. So he's trying to cover it so the people don't have to go direct to Jerusalem. They'll stay favorable to him and won't return and say, well, if we're in Jerusalem, why don't we return to Rehoboam to the south? And that's what Jeroboam is trying to avoid. Now, something that's interesting also at this point, let's read verse 28 of chapter 12, if you would. 1 Kings 12, 28. It says, so the king consulted and made two golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold, your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. He's already referring to these golden calves as God that brought them out of Egypt. Have we heard that language before? Back in Exodus 32, where was it? What happened? Doesn't take much time. What? That's what I'm going back to, exactly. Exodus 32, if you would. Beginning at verse 1. Exodus 32 and verse 1. It's when the people got tired of waiting for Moses up on Mount Sinai. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron, and said to him, come, let us make a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, this man who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Aaron said to them, tear off the gold rings which are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. The very same language. How quickly they turned to idolatry and look for something. It must have been very common back then for them to have something in the house that, which to us would be odd, that they would attribute it to deity. It must have been very common. Because for us, it seems very obvious that if you have something in the house that looks like some kind of foreign object, we obviously know to us that would be idolatry. But to them, it must have been very common. Why would they turn to idolatry so easily and have these figures in their houses or their homes and so forth? That's just an oddity. But nonetheless, Jeroboam makes it very convenient for them, Dan and Bethel, to continue their worship to God and not having to go to Jerusalem at all, or to avoid having to go to Jerusalem. They build houses and temples for these idols, and the next mistake that Jeroboam makes is he starts taking priests from anyone who is willing to be a priest, didn't have to be a Levite. He began making them priests to serve these idols and serve in these temples or sacrifice on any altar he could come up with, pretty much. Again, a lesson for us to learn. We don't always have the right way, and we need to look to God and His commands to find the right way. It is not up to us to decide, to devise. And in verse 33, continues that. It says, Jeroboam devised in his own heart. He thought these things up and thought they would be okay to God. It'd be acceptable. Well, was it? We'll turn to chapter 13 and find out pretty quickly. He thought he could add whatever he wanted or whatever he could think up was best. for service to God. Obviously, we know it doesn't work that way. Chapter 13. Prophet of the Lord is sent to him to warn him that a Josiah will be born of the house of David of the southern kingdom of Judah. He will come and sacrifice the priests who burn incense on the very altar that Jeroboam is standing at while they're speaking. What's the sign that these things are going to take place? The prophet says the very day of this prophecy, the altar is going to split and the ashes are going to pour out from it. While Jeroboam's standing there at the altar sacrificing, he raises his hand and says, "Seize him," to this prophet. When he says that, his arm stiffens, dries up in an outward position. He can't pull his arm back to himself. Obviously, it frightens him. The altar splits before him as they're speaking. The ashes pour out, just as the Lord had said and prophesied through this prophet. And this prophet is nameless. So Jeroboam immediately asks this prophet to pray for him on behalf of him. And Jeroboam's hand was restored. Another oddity there is verse 6 of chapter 13. The king said to the man of God, "Please entreat the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored to me." So the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and it became as it was before. I failed to look in any other versions. Any other versions read differently? He's saying, "Entreat your God." Does anybody else read differently? It's very odd. Why would he say your God? Why wouldn't he say, "Please entreat our God for us to see what God wants me to do to fix this"? It's very odd. Does anybody else, or does it still say the same thing? Your God. So it's like, you see the point that he's saying, your God. Why is it not his God? It's just strange. Anyway, okay. So, but nonetheless, his hand is restored back the way it was. Again, the prophet remains nameless. So Jeroboam tries to befriend this prophet and says, "Please stay, go home with me." So the prophet tells him what the Lord has already warned him. The Lord has told this man not to eat bread, drink water, and to go home a different way. For this prophet tells Jeroboam, he begins his journey in verse 10. This is where the chapter takes an odd twist. You may remember it as we get into it. An older prophet, verse 11 through 19. Didn't he move it forward? Excuse me there. There's the map. Looks much better than the one up there, I'm sure. I didn't even bring my pointer, but it's here. All right. There's Jerusalem, Bethel, and Shechem, as I mentioned. And then Dan is not on here, but it's just north of Lake Hula, which is there. Dan is up here, Bethel here. And you see, it's the coloration is a little different, but it's the yellow region down here, Judah, and the northern brown. So Bethel is just north of the southern region, southern boundary of the northern kingdom of Israel. FYI. Okay. All right. As we continue on back to verse 11. So, we have this older prophet, again, nameless, just like the younger prophet, living in Bethel. How does he find out about the events of the day? His sons are talking about it. The older prophet overhears them and asks them about this younger prophet who has just prophesied to the king, been there, split the altar, healed Jeroboam's hand. The older prophet asks, "Which way did he go? Which way was he going home?" They told him. So immediately he takes off after him in verse 13, catches up with him. Verse 15 invites him back to his home. Again, the younger prophet tells him what the Lord has said. "I'm not supposed to eat bread, drink water, or return. I'm supposed to return home a different way." This is where the older prophet tells him an angel told him otherwise and convinced this younger prophet to go back with him to Bethel, to eat with him, to stay with him, to visit with him. And the younger prophet concedes, did so, verse 19. Went back with the older prophet. And we may remember what the consequences were when he follows through with this. As they're sitting at the table, eating, the word of the Lord came to the older prophet who had invited him back. And he prophesies and tells, since he had disobeyed, this younger prophet had disobeyed, his body would not make it back, and his body would not be able to be buried with his fathers. Verse 24, when this prophet left, a lion met him and killed him. Verse 28, the lion did not eat the man, nor did it tear the donkey. It just stood there, showing that it was of God, because normally a lion would either eat the man or the donkey. Neither one. So it's showing that it was definitely of God. Punishment for having done or disobeyed God's command. Lesson learned here, I guess, would be beware of secondhand information. It's easy for us today to beware of false prophets, because we can pretty much know that prophecies don't come today. But back then, if they didn't have the written word, it was kind of hard to determine who was a true prophet and who was a false prophet. Much harder than it is for us today, because we have the word before us. Nonetheless, beware of secondhand information. Yes, sir?
That brings to mind Galatians 1:8, where it says, but even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. Basically, what the old prophet did is said, an angel told me this. And, you know, even in the young prophet, he just told the king, you know, there's no way you can give me half a kingdom. I'm not going to stay. So he knew what he was supposed to do. But then he let himself be deceived by, I guess, second guessing.
Well, that's we all wonder why he did. You know, how did this older prophet convince him, or sound so convincing? He just said an angel had told him. I mean, it looks like you'd check your sources and say prove it or whatever, but yet, still, him conceding was part of the problem. It wasn't totally the older prophet's fault, but yet the younger prophet did have to agree and go back. And consequence was he didn't live much longer for it. It also shows us that if God says it and sets it in place, we will suffer the consequences. And the younger prophet did suffer the consequences of what he did. Good point. Anything else? It's awful quiet tonight. You're welcome to question or comment. Yes, sir.
This point goes back to the Exodus as well. I think a lot of times people assume that the idolatry of God's people in the Old Testament was forsaking the one true God and going and worshiping these other gods. But there's really no evidence that they ever completely turned away from God in their own mind. You know, they make this image, which clearly is a, you know, complete violation of what God had told them. But in their mind, this is an image of Yahweh God, the one that brought us out of Egypt. And it's the same way with these golden calves that have been in Bethel. And I think a modern-day counterpart to that kind of thing, we see in the religious world that, you know, you can put any sign out front of any church building and say, this is a church that belongs to God. But saying that doesn't make it so. And you can imitate the truth to a certain extent. You can make counterfeits and look a whole lot like what the truth is. But in the final analysis, if it isn't exactly what God said, it is something different. And no matter how much we may satisfy ourselves, it's still close enough. It's still, we're calling it the worship of the one true God. It wasn't. And that's what they failed to recognize.
That it's vain. If it's not exactly as God says it and it shows, it's vain. It's worthless. It doesn't live up to God's standards. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, is it's why they're so quickly to build an idol and build something that they relate or call God. And yet, to us, it's so clear that we don't need an image to relate to God. We realize God's a spirit, so therefore we don't need that physical thing to look at, as they seem to have to want to have, always referring back to God. So it's just an oddity. Good point. Yes, sir.
The lesson there is, you know, their culture was so steeped in having to have some object that you looked at as part of your worship. We need to stop and ask, well, what are the cultural things around us that we accept without question, and find some way to accommodate those things or rationalize, well, it's okay to do these things, or, you know, that's the struggle that we have. We look at idolatry and it's just silly to us, but really no more so than our pagan neighbors. They don't worship idols either. You know, but what are the things of our culture that are such an influence on us that, you know, maybe people 1,000 years from now look back on us and say, those silly Christians, they thought it was okay to do this, that, and the other. How did they justify that? Well, we do. We live in a materialistic society. If we want that, we'll find some way to say, hey, I'm being a great Christian while still engaging in all of these cultural desires and the American way of life and all of that without critiquing it through the viewpoint of the Bible.
Yes.
I was going to say, too, going back to 3 times it was mentioned, you know, the young prophet came by the word of the Lord. He says that he was sent to Bethel by the word of the Lord, and then he told the king by the word of the Lord.
Older prophet,
by the word of the Lord, you know, so it's just, he's just a, 3 times, I mean, in his mind, the word of the Lord was this, and yet he came off of it because the old man said an angel said something different. And I think that goes back, I mean, we can learn that in the New Testament, it's staying by the word of the Lord, you know, the most important thing, just to err off of it a little bit and get in trouble.
As you mentioned earlier, make sure it's God's word.
Right.
You know, God's word. Just saying, we have a Becky Jim.
The we're saying the same thing, Becky and Alabama. But they tell us that it's part of their culture to, like, just add other gods to their ones of the ones that were worshiped.
They need to see it to believe it, in other words, right?
Right.
Yeah. In other words, that's more convincing as they look at it. Very good point. Just a second, Joe. Yes, Tim.
Not to belabor the point, but I think a very interesting passage is found in Genesis chapter 31 in verse 19, where we have Jacob, who is fleeing from Laban. Jacob has worked for Rachel and Leah. And in verse 19, while Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And Laban pursues, and he says, look, I understand you're leaving, but did you have to steal my gods? And he searches for them, and of course Rachel has them hidden. But the final point there in verse 42, it's unrelated, but Jacob says, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me. And I can understand why it would be the fear of Isaac. If God had told my dad to kill me, it would take me a while to accept that faith. But the problem that God's people had with idols predates
this time. Yeah, and even this time, it shows so obviously through this time period that they were heavily into idolatry.
Yep.
Definitely. Yes, Joe?
Well, I would like to bring up a point of conversation in that we today in this society, we don't have the same kind of problem with idols like they had in the ancient times. Like you said, we don't have a little statue that we make offerings to and praise to, a little statue and call in God or anything like that. But the Bible cautions us against, my Bible study fails me. I don't know where it says this. Somebody with a better knowledge would know. But the Bible says somewhere that friendship with the world is enmity with God. And what they're talking about there is just common everyday things that if we love those things, then we're making ourselves enemies of God. In another place it says that covetousness and lust, lasciviousness, amounts to idolatry. So we may not face the same temptations with idols that they faced in ancient Syria or in Palestine, like having a little statue, but we have statues of a different kind in this society, in this life. You know, maybe our TV is a little too important to us, or maybe we like racing cars or whatever it is that, you know, each person has their own interests. I know I'm guilty as anyone, you know.
If we let anything of the world hinder us, or exactly, hinder us or keep us from service to God, that's idolatry. And we would even be more, you might say, tempted as they were, as we have more money, you might say, and more monetary things we can purchase than they could have. Back in that day and time. So we have a lot of temptations for worldly things to hinder us. Sunday morning, there's a lot of things you could do. Lots of things you could think of doing other than coming to services. So those are temptations, and those are things that could be idolatry if they keep us from serving God. Just like we got the... Yes, sir?
I feel like good part points. Of the value in this, we may have kind of touched on it, but just to shed light on another aspect, is this man who comes to the younger prophet is an older prophet who, as a younger prophet, he probably would have thought, this is someone that I can rely on, this is someone I can, whose word I can look up to, and this is maybe a lesson we can learn ourselves, where you get this whole mentality of, oh, they're a trustworthy person. I can trust what they're going to say. Because we have that Galatians passage that says, even if we are an angel from heaven tells you something else, you know, it's let them be accursed. It emphasizes the need for us to look for this ourselves. And that may have been implied in what we said earlier, but I think it's a big lesson we can learn from this, that you get, I think a lot of the problems that you see in the world today are because of that mentality. Oh, this is a person I can trust. I'll let them mandate what I'm doing. And
exactly.
So it's this need to really look into it ourselves. This younger prophet had the word of God given to him, as do we. And it's this same thing of, are we going to go by what we have, by what we need to establish in ourselves, or what someone else is going
to do? We have the responsibility to justify it, to check it out, to make sure it is truth.
Exactly.
And you're right. We shouldn't just trust because somebody said it. That's the mistake. A lot of people, you see worldly people do that all the time. They just pick a congregation, just go because they like the words or like the speaker, and they hear what they want to hear. Absolutely. Yes, sir?
About 50 years ago, it was quite common to see about one car in 10 with a little statue up on the dashboard, and they thought that statue of a saint or somebody would keep them from harm. You don't see that too much now.
Now, I know what you're saying. I remember that. I remember what that's... It's true. It's really odd that, yes, I guess it comes in phases where they are, it's just a, so it still happens even in, quote, modern times. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
This young prophet, unfortunately, got the hierarchy of authority confused. And as Travis mentioned, he bestowed upon this older man false respect when it should have given the ultimate authority to God and yet given him the original authority.
And he should have checked the sources out for himself, but trusted the older prophet too much. As we continue in verse 26 through 30, the older prophet finds out what happened to the younger prophet, went and took the body and buried him in his own tomb, his own grave. And then in verse 31, the older prophet directs his sons to make sure that when he dies, he's buried in the same tomb. As we continue in verse 33 into chapter 14, Jeroboam begins reigning over Israel. As we begin chapter, well, that's 33. As we begin chapter 4, let's go ahead and skip to chapter 4. No, we're going to go and read the first one. Okay. Let me finish. Oh, it is chapter 4. No, it is chapter 14. Excuse me. Apologize. Beginning of chapter 14. Yeah, Jeroboam is reigning, and his son Abijah becomes sick. He asked his wife to disguise herself and go to Shiloh to see Ahijah the prophet. This prophet is the same one that told Jeroboam in the beginning that he was to become king. So, verse 3, she takes food, honey, a gift, to find out what's going to happen to the sick son. She does so. In verse 4, when she comes to Ahijah, Ahijah is older. His vision is poor based on his age and so forth. But verse 5, the word of the Lord had come to Ahijah to tell him what was going to happen. about Abijah and that Jeroboam's wife was coming disguised to see him and to ask him what was to happen to the son, Abijah. So, as verse 6, when she arrives, Ahijah knows it's her. Here's her footsteps coming in. And then in verse 6, he tells her exactly what's going to happen, that Abijah will die. Verse 17 and 18, let's go ahead and read that, of chapter 14. Let me start with verse 6. Chapter 14, verse 6. When Ahijah heard the sound of her feet coming in the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another woman? For I am sent to you with a harsh message." And that's when he goes on to tell her that Abijah will die. In verses 19 through 20, Jeroboam reigned for 22 years, as it says, and did evil, and his son Abijah did die. Nadab, his son, takes the throne in verses 19 and 20 of chapter 14. That leads to 21. I shouldn't have put that part up so quickly. But 21 through 31 is where Rehoboam, we'll go back to Rehoboam. We've talked about Jeroboam to the south. I'm sorry, to the north. We're going back to Rehoboam to the south. Judah. Rehoboam, again, son of Solomon. He reigns in Jerusalem. He was 41 years old when he became king, reigned 17 years. He allowed idol worship. He didn't stop the worship that his dad Solomon had stopped, or had started, excuse me. He allowed the Asherim, idol of a female deity. He allowed widespread and abundant idol worship. And he also, in verse 24, allowed male cult prostitutes. So he's going off the deep end, you might say, and continuing what his dad had started, Solomon, not trying to stop any of this idolatry. Judah as a nation continued the evil activities of the people who had lived there before, as mentioned in verse 24. Now the consequences of what he had done. Okay, let's go back. I need to finish that one, excuse me. All right. There we go. 21 through 31, the consequences of his actions through 28, 25 through 28. In the fifth year of Rehoboam's reign, Shishak, king of Egypt, went to war against Jerusalem and took the treasuries of the temple, the king's palace, shields of gold that Solomon had made. Pretty much Shishak of Egypt took everything, anything of value he could, from Rehoboam. It doesn't appear that Rehoboam was able to stop him. Verse 27, it indicates that Rehoboam began replacing the shields with bronze, a lesser quality, of course, than gold or silver. Verse 30, it mentions that strife was continual between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, north and south, the kingdom of Israel against the kingdom of Judah, continually. Verse 31, Rehoboam dies and was buried in Jerusalem. His son Abijam takes the throne, but Abijam, this is over Judah. Yeah, see, I'm even getting confused because it was Abijah that was sick for Jeroboam. And it's Abijam. It's very confusing. Abijam reigns over Judah beginning of chapter 15. And I guess that tells us we're going to stop there at chapter 15. Didn't quite get as far as we did last week, but nonetheless. Any questions or comments before we end? Yes, sir.
Just a very interesting note in chapter 14, verse 15, Ahijah the prophet actually prophesies about the Assyrian captivity in the very first and during the reign of Jeroboam. Talks about the Lord will strike Israel as a reed shaken in the water. He'll uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to the fathers and will scatter them beyond the river because they have made their images.
They had several warnings that if they didn't continue following God, that they would be taken captive. Even we studied last week that Solomon is telling that when he dedicated the temple, that he's reminding them himself that we have to stay faithful to God and we will be taken captive. And it's kind of prophetic that he starts them off with idolatry and allows it, and it becomes rampant and leads to the downfall. Nonetheless, remember, I over J, J over R. So remember that as far as the divisions. As we'll see as we go further, as they're coming in, that The northern kingdom of Israel does not have any good kings. They're all, according to scriptures, mentioned as being evil or not doing right. Now, to the south, we're eventually going to run into one good one. I was hoping to get to it tonight, but Asa is a bright spot in the southern kingdom of Judah. And we will study him in chapter 15, a bright spot. He did right. Tried to get rid of a lot of the, come on in guys, a lot of the idolatry. Come on in. To the south. Southern kingdom of Judah. And it's shown in that the northern kingdom of Israel does end up going into captivity much quicker than the southern kingdom. Unfortunately, the turning from idolatry of the southern kingdom of Judah was not enough to stop God's plan that they be taken to captivity. They had been so evil for so long. But nonetheless, we'll pick up a chapter 15 next week. Thank you for your questions and comments. And again, I forgot to pass out the next handout in just a moment. Actually, we'll do that next week because we've got several chapters to go. We'll just pass that out next week.